Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. As always, we want to tell you, we want to hear from you if you know of any cold cases that were eventually solved. If you do, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com, then go to the Suggest a Case page. On that same page, you can also suggest cases for our two YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. Sometimes we encounter fascinating cases, but there isn't enough material to make an episode. So we decided to cover two of those cases in a double feature this week. For our first case, we're going back to August 1985. The musical Dreamgirls closed at the Imperial Theater in New York City on August 11, 1985, after 1,522 performances. The musical opened on December 20, 1981. Dreamgirls has been an R&B trio called the Dreamettes, but they later called themselves the Dreams. It follows their trials and tribulations in the world of the 1960s and 70s music business. The musical was a massive hit and was nominated for 14 Tony Awards. It won 6, including Best Book of a Musical and Best Choreography. In 2006, it was made into a major motion picture, starring Beyoncé, Jamie Foxx, Jennifer Hudson, and Eddie Murphy. The movie was nominated for 8 Academy Awards. Jennifer Hudson won Best Supporting Actress, and the film also won the Oscar for Best Sound Mixing. On August 9, 1985, the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure hit the theaters. The character Pee-wee Herman was developed and portrayed by Paul Reubens. He created the character in 1977 while he was a member of the improv group The Groundlings. In 1980, Reubens debuted the play The Pee-wee Herman Show in Los Angeles, California. It was a huge hit, and HBO filmed it for a special. This led to Reubens developing a Pee-wee Herman movie for Warner Brothers. Reubens co-wrote the screenplay with Phil Hartman and Michael Verhaal. Herman was also a member of the Groundlings, and he had his own successful career as a comedic actor. Tragically, Herman was killed by his wife in May 1998. He was 49 years old. Tasked with directing the film was someone who had never directed a major motion picture before, Tim Burton. Pee-wee's Big Adventure was a success, earning over $40 million on a $7 million budget. Reubens starred in two other Pee-wee Herman movies and a TV series that ran on CBS from 1986 to 1991. The success of Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice in 1988 helped secure Tim Burton as the director of 1989's Batman. He's gone on to direct dozens of other films, many were critical and financial successes. Paul Reubens continued to portray Pee-wee Herman until he died in 2023. He died from cancer at the age of 70. On August 31, 1985, Richard Ramirez, aka the Night Stalker, was arrested in Los Angeles. At the time, Ramirez was wanted for a series of 13 murders committed in the previous 14 months. Ramirez was connected to the murders after his fingerprint was found in a stolen car he used as a getaway vehicle in his last murder. His mugshot was made public, and the police were on the lookout for him. When his mugshot was made public, Ramirez was out of the state. He returned to Los Angeles on August 31st, and people recognized him. He tried to steal a car, but a group of citizens surrounded him, and he was beaten until the police arrived and arrested him. In 1989, Ramirez was convicted of 13 murders and sentenced to death. If you want to hear more about Richard Ramirez, we cover his crimes in episode 15. The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News was the number one song on the Billboard charts on August 21, 1985. The song was from the soundtrack of the number one movie that day, Back to the Future. In the summer of 1985, David Reed was 13 years old. He lived in Schuylkill Haven, Pennsylvania. In 1985, the borough had a population of about 5,700 people. Schuylkill Haven is about 130 miles west of New York City and 90 miles north of Philadelphia. David was getting ready to go into the 7th grade. He was the youngest of 5 children. His father died when David was just 13 months old. A year earlier, in August 1984, his 27-year-old brother, Ronald, died after falling ill. When David grew up, he wanted to be a pilot. He had always wanted to fly. In 1985, David worked as a paperboy for the local newspaper. On the afternoon of August 21st, 1985, David set off from his home on his bicycle. It was a nice day in Schuylkill Haven. There were clear skies and the temperature was in the mid-70s. David's mother, Joan, became concerned when he didn't return home for supper. She was mostly concerned because he had juvenile diabetes, so he needed to eat. His brothers went looking for him, but they found no trace of him. As it got darker, his mother panicked and called the police. They launched an immediate search. The police questioned his family and doubted that David would have run away. He got along well with his family and had no reason to run away. The next day, David's 26-year-old sister, Virginia, found his bike in some bushes near the railroad tracks near their home. This alarmed his family even more. David loved his bike and he went everywhere with it. David's family was devastated by his disappearance. Having a family member go missing is terrible under any circumstances, but David vanished 6 days before the first anniversary of his older brother Ronald's death. The police investigated the disappearance. They heard David was going to the railroad tracks to hang out with two people. The two people were questioned, and they said that they had not seen David that day. The police also heard that David had been at a house party. They questioned many people at the party, and no one recalled seeing David there. David's family never gave up looking for him. They hung up missing persons flyers around the town. The police also continued to search for him. But still, no trace of 13-year-old David Reed was found. Then, on December 15, 1985, nearly 4 months after David went missing, the police got a bizarre phone call from a local resident. Officers went to his home, and on the man's kitchen table was a human skull. The man explained he had been looking for his cat with his dog in a wooded area behind the home. The dog found the skull and brought it to him. He decided to bring it home and call the police. The man then led them to the area where the skull was found. It was about half a mile from where David's bike had been found. The police found more human bones in the area. The remains were partially buried under some leaves and foliage. They also found some clothing. The shirt matched the description of the shirt David was wearing when he went missing. Using dental records, they confirmed they were the remains of 13-year-old David Reed. Then, another man approached the police, and he said he also had some bones. This included part of David's jawbone. The man's home also backed onto the wooded area. His dog found the bones and brought them home, and he assumed that they were animal bones. He had kept the bones in a bucket on his front porch. The pathologist determined they were David's bones. An autopsy was performed, and it shocked many people. The pathologist thought that David had died from complications of juvenile diabetes, but the police were not convinced it was a natural death. They had anthropologists examine the bones. He noted that there were large cracks in the back of David's skull. The problem was that this alone was not an indication of foul play. For example, David could have had an accident or gone sick and fell and hit the back of his head on a rock. So the manner of death was labeled as undetermined. After the remains were found, a funeral for David was held. What bothered many people who attended was that David was a large 13-year-old boy, but all they found of him were bones, so his remains were buried in a small baby casket. The undetermined ruling did not sit well with David's older sister, Virginia. For years, she advocated for the case to be reopened, but nothing was done. The biggest barrier was the undetermined label. The police could investigate, only to find out that no crime had been committed. They had other things to deal with, so David's death remained a mystery. The death took a devastating toll on David's mother, Joan. She started drinking more often. In June 2000, Joan died at age 62 from cirrhosis of the liver. David's sister, Virginia, continued to fight to have his case reopened. In June 2005, Virginia finally got her wish. A lot had changed in those 20 years. Major movies released in 1985 were The Breakfast Club, The Goonies, and Teen Wolf. In 2005, three notable movies that were released in theaters were Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Brokeback Mountain, and Hitch. The Grammy Awards are held annually in February, and they honor music that was released the previous year. So at the 1986 Grammy Awards, the charity single We Are the World by USA for Africa took home Record of the Year and Song of the Year, and Phil Collins' No Jacket Required won Album of the Year. Rock bands dominated the 2006 Grammy Awards. Green Day took home Record of the Year for Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and U2 won Album of the Year for How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, and Song of the Year for Sometimes You Can't Make It on Your Own. TV shows that debuted in 1985 were The Golden Girls, Growing Pains, and She-Ra, Princess of Power. In 2005, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Criminal Minds, and Deadliest Catch all debuted. Popular books published in 1985 include the debut novel from Bret Easton Ellis, Lesson Zero, Jonathan Kellerman's first book, When the Bow Breaks, and The Polar Express by Chris Van Allsburg. In 2005, some popular books that were published were The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak, Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro, and Marley and Me by John Grogan. When the case was reopened in 2005, David's sister, Virginia, was happy that the mystery of her brother's death might finally be solved. When the cold case investigator looked at the file, something immediately caught his attention. It was the location of where David's body was found. It wasn't a place where children were known to play. If David had died there, what was he doing there? Or he could have been killed elsewhere, and then his body was dumped there. Also, if David's death was natural or an accident, how come his body was partially buried? Based on this, the detective believed that David had been murdered. One suspect was a person who had been convicted of sexually abusing children, but the man had an airtight alibi. He was in prison at the time of David's death. The cold case investigator decided to go public about the case being reopened, and he had Virginia speak with the media. They hoped the media campaign would stir up some memories or encourage a previously quiet witness to come forward. Then the detective conducted interviews with anyone who knew David. Several people he talked to mentioned that a man named Joe Geiger acted oddly after David died. He became incredibly reclusive. It turned out that Geiger was connected to the case. After David's remains were found, a man came forward with bones that he said his dog had collected from the wooded area. That man was Joe Geiger. Geiger had even given an interview to a local television station about finding the bones. He had never been considered a suspect in the case. Geiger was 20 years old at the time of David's death. He was a small-time marijuana dealer in town. He grew marijuana in the wooded area behind his home. It was the same wooded area where David's body had been found. The cold case detective interviewed Geiger and initially claimed that he had only met David once. The detective put more pressure on Geiger by telling him that there were rumors around town that he was the one who killed David. Geiger then admitted he was there when David was killed, but he wasn't the one who killed him. He said that John Fry, who was 14 at the time, was the one who killed David. Fry was a friend of David's. He said that the three of them were hanging out drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana. Geiger said that Fry punched David in the face and he fell and hit his head. The cold case investigator then went and confronted Fry. Fry gave a similar account, but he said that Geiger was the one who threw the punch. He said that they were drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana in the back of an abandoned caboose. Geiger accused David of stealing his marijuana plants. He punched David, and David fell in the caboose. When he did, he struck his head on the railroad track. He was unconscious, but alive. Fry said that Geiger told him to leave and that he would deal with it. Fry, who was afraid of 20-year-old Geiger, did as he was told. He claimed he didn't know that Geiger had killed David until David's remains were found months later. Fry said he never came forward because he had always been afraid of Geiger. The police then decided to have David's remains exhumed to see if they could find any evidence that would help determine if Joe Geiger or John Fry was telling the truth. In January 2007, nearly 21 and a half years after David's death, his bones were exhumed. The cold case investigator contacted a highly regarded anthropologist and she agreed to examine the bones. The anthropologist found a series of hairline fractures on the left cheek. She concluded that David had been punched in the face hard enough that he would have fallen over. Then he cracked the back of his skull. So the cause of death was changed to blunt force trauma, and the manner of death was changed from undetermined to homicide. Then it was just a matter of figuring out if it was Joe Geiger or John Fry who killed him. One thing they noted was that the hairline fractures were on the left side of David's face. So he was probably punched by a left-handed person. He was also struck with enough force that it caused the fractures. John Fry was right-handed, and at the time of David's death, he was 14, while Geiger was left-handed and 20 years old at the time of David's death. The police also learned at the time of David's death, Geiger was angry that someone was stealing his marijuana plants. This gave him a reason to assault David, whereas there was no reason for Fry to punch David. So the police concluded that Joe Geiger was the one who killed David Reed. On August 21, 2008, the 23rd anniversary of David's murder, 43-year-old Joe Geiger was arrested and charged with third-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, abuse of a corpse, and tampering with evidence. Tragically, David's strongest advocate and the driving force behind getting his case reopened, his sister Virginia, did not live to see the arrest. She died a year and a half earlier in January 2007 at age 47. She died 19 days before David's remains were exhumed. Virginia's family said that she had turned to drugs to cope. Unfortunately, the district attorney did not have the strongest case against Joe Geiger. There was no physical evidence and just one witness to the murder, John Fry. If the jury did not believe Fry, then Geiger could be acquitted and they would never be able to try him again for the murder. So Geiger was offered a plea deal. The district attorney would drop the third-degree murder charge and he could plead guilty to involuntary manslaughter. He would get a sentence of 1 to 2 years of prison. In exchange, he had to tell the police what happened the day David was killed. Geiger agreed and he confessed. His story slightly differed from what he and Fry initially told the police. Geiger said that he believed David was stealing his marijuana plants. He and Fry went looking for him and found him in the caboose. David was known to hang out there. Geiger said that he accused David of stealing the plants and then punched him in the face. David fell out of the caboose and hit his head on the rail. David was still alive and Geiger said he panicked. He and Fry went downtown. Geiger said he returned a short time later and he was hoping David had woken up and he was gone. But he was still lying in the same spot. He thought he was dead, so he dragged his body into the wooded area and covered him with leaves and other foliage. It's believed that if Geiger had gotten him help right away, David might have survived. In February 2009, Joseph Geiger was sentenced to 1 to 2 years of prison. Accounting for time served, Geiger could have been released as early as August 2009. David Reed's family was upset he received such a short sentence, but they were happy that after 23 years, the case was finally closed. Part of Geiger's plea deal is that he had to pay for David's reburial. According to Geiger's Facebook account, since 2018, he's been working as a forklift operator. For our second case, we're going back to September 1977. On September 1st, 1977, 43-year-old Renee Richards played her first women's single match at a major tennis championship. She played 32-year-old Virginia Wade, who was the reigning Wimbledon champion. For over a year, Richards, who was born male, had fought to play in a major women's tennis championship. She underwent sexual reassignment surgery in 1975. After she was outed by TV anchor Richard Carlson, Tucker Carlson's father, in 1976, the United States Tennis Association, the Women's Tennis Association, and the United States Open Committee created a new rule. Female competitors had to verify their sex through genetic screening. Richards refused to do the testing, and she was banned from competing in Wimbledon and the Italian Open in 1977. Richards challenged the rule in the courts. She said that the rule was gender discrimination. In August 1977, the New York Supreme Court ruled in her favor. The judge ruled that Richards was now a female, and the rule was created to discriminate against her. Richards' first match at the U.S. Open was a media spectacle, but was considered a major disappointment. Virginia Wade crushed Richards. According to the Washington Post, quote, "Richard was too tentative in her shot-making and too slow a foot to offer much resistance to Wade's barrage of attacking strokes and drop shots," unquote. In the first set, Wade lost her serve only once. Wade won the match 6-1 and 6-4. However, Richards went on to the finals in doubles competition. Nevertheless, Renee Richards' case was considered a major victory for transgender rights. Richards went on to become an activist for transgender people in sports. On September 10, 1977, France carried out the last execution via the guillotine. The guillotine was first used as a method of execution in France during the French Revolution. Although gory, it was considered more humane than their previous form of execution, which was the breaking wheel. The condemned was tied to a wheel and then spun. Their limbs were then struck with a cudgel, which would break their bones. Depending on the severity of the crime, more blows were given before they were finally struck in the neck or chest, called the coup de grace or the blow of mercy. Other times, they were not given these fatal blows and were left to die in agony on the wheel. This could take days. It was a brutal form of execution that dates back to ancient Rome. At the time, beheadings were used as a form of execution in Europe, but it was only for criminals of noble birth. Joseph Ignace Guillotin was a French physician and politician. He also opposed the death penalty, but he was instrumental in passing the law that execution should be carried out via a machine that beheads painlessly. It became law in March 1792. On April 25, 1792, the first execution via the guillotine was performed. The first person executed was highwayman Nicolas Jacques Peltier. Although guillotine's name has become an eponym for the device, he did not invent it. It was developed by harpsichord maker Tobias Schmidt and the king's physician Antoine Louis. The guillotine was used as France's method of execution for the next 185 years. In 1973, 21-year-old Elizabeth Bousquet went to the police in Marseille, France. Bousquet said that her 23-year-old boyfriend, Hamida Dejean Duby, was trying to force her into sex work. Jean Duby was born in Tunisia and moved to Marseille in 1968. Jean Duby was arrested but released a short time later. After he was released, he connected with two other women and forced them into sex work. On July 3, 1974, Jean Duby kidnapped Bousquet. It took her to his home. In front of the two women he had forced into sex work, he severely beat Bousquet and burned her breasts and genitals with lit cigarettes. He then took her to an isolated area and strangled her to death. He was arrested and convicted. On September 10, 1977, Jean Duby was led to the guillotine and beheaded. The attending doctor said that the 27-year-old man was responsive for 30 seconds after he was decapitated. It was the last time the guillotine was used in a government-sanctioned execution in the world. It was also the last legally sanctioned execution via beheading in the Western world. Beheadings are still an official form of execution in some countries. For example, Saudi Arabia still executes people by decapitation, but a sword is used instead of a guillotine. France abolished the death penalty 4 years later, in 1981. On September 20th, 1977, one of the most notorious sitcom episodes aired. It was Season 5, Episode 3, Hollywood Part 3, of the ABC TV show Happy Days. In the episode, one of the main characters, Arthur Fonzarelli, better known as Fonzie, or the Fonz, agrees to the challenge of jumping over a shark on water skis. An estimated 30 million people watched the episode. However, it is widely regarded as the start of the decline of the show's quality. In 1985, two University of Michigan students, John Hine and Sean Connolly, coined the term jumping the shark. It's when a television show reaches the point where the quality starts to decline because its core content has been exhausted and far-fetched events are included for the sake of novelty. Nevertheless, Happy Days continued for another six seasons. In 1997, John Hine launched the website JumpTheShark.com, and he posted a list of 200 television shows he believed had jumped the shark. He sold his company 9 years later for over $1 million. The website is no longer operational, and if you go to JumpTheShark.com, it redirects you to TVGuide.com. On September 24th, 1977, the number one song was Best of My Love by The Emotions. The number one movie was the biggest film of the year, Star Wars. On the night of September 23rd, 1977, 29-year-old Doris Arndt went to a bar in Midland County, Michigan, with some friends. Doris was married and had two children. One was 13 and the other was 10. She worked at Tri-City Plastics as a union steward. Doris stayed at the bar until it closed in the early morning of September 24th. Sadly, she never made it home after the bar. Her husband thought she was staying with friends, so he wasn't too worried when she didn't come home. But then he became worried when she didn't come home that night. The next morning, he reported her missing. Ten days later, on October 7th, 1989, Doris's dead body was found in a wooded area. She had been raped and strangled to death. One of the first suspects was Doris's husband, John. He did a polygraph exam, and he passed, so he was cleared as a suspect. The police talked to people who were at the bar that night. Several people saw Doris arguing with a man before the bar closed for the night. They did more follow-up interviews, but no arrests were made. So the case went cold. In 1993, the police said that they had a suspect, but lacked the evidence to charge him. Then, in 2007, the police got a phone call that got the ball rolling on the case. A lot had changed in the 30 years since the murder of Doris Arndt. Popular movies released in 1977 were Saturday Night Fever, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Eraserhead. In 2007, 28 Days Later, Ratatouille, and There Will Be Blood were all released. The three top songs of the Billboard charts in 1977 were Tonight's the Night, Gonna Be Alright by Rod Stewart, I Just Want to Be Your Everything by Andy Gibb, and The Best of My Love by The Emotions. 30 years later, the three top songs were Irreplaceable by Beyoncé, Umbrella by Rihanna featuring Jay-Z, and The Sweet Escape by Gwen Stefani featuring Akon. Some popular shows that debuted in 1977 were Chips, Logan's Run, and Soap. Soap was a parody of daytime soap operas. It was considered highly controversial at the time because of its subject matter, including sexuality and adultery. Religious groups protested its release. However, ABC refused to back down and released it with a viewer discretion advisory. It was the first time a warning was used on television before a fictional show. Soap was a massive hit and ran for four seasons. New shows that debuted in 2007 were Fly the Conchords, Damages, and iCarly. New products in 1977 were the Chia Pet, the Atari 2600, and Post-it Notes. In 2007, new products were the Amazon Kindle, iPod Touch, and ToothTunes toothbrushes. In 1977, new products of the world of drinks and snacks were Cookie Crisp cereal, Bubblicious gum, and Billy Beer, which Billy Carter, the older brother of then-President Jimmy Carter, promoted. If you were looking for something to consume in 2007, you could have a Baconator from Wendy's, Pepsi Zero Sugar, and Five Gum. The phone call that the police received in 2007 was from a freelance journalist in Arizona. He was inquiring about Doris's murder for a project he was working on. He then told the detectives that, in the 1980s, he had interviewed a man, and the man confessed to the murder. It turned out that the man he interviewed was the prime suspect in the case, who was very well known to the police. He was one of the state's most notorious criminals, Robert Lee Haggert. Haggert was born in 1950 in Michigan. He spent his early life in rural Isabella County, Michigan. When his mother married his stepfather, he moved into the small village of Rosebush, Michigan. Haggert didn't finish high school. Instead, in 1968, he enlisted in the army and was trained as a sharpshooter. He was first sent to Germany and then to Vietnam. He wasn't in Vietnam long before he was sent back to the States. The Detroit Free Press tried to find out why his tour was so short, but they couldn't find any information. Haggert told people that he was injured, but reporters could not find any record of that. Nevertheless, Haggert ended up back in Rosebush, where he worked on farms, sold livestock feed, and worked as an auctioneer at the stockyards. He became a regular at local bars, where he was known as a hard-drinking womanizer. On June 1, 1974, Haggert attended a wedding reception. It was the night before his 24th birthday. He gave a 14-year-old girl who was at the wedding a ride home. In his truck, they had sexual relations. Haggert was charged with rape. In November 1974, in court, he admitted to making out with the girl and touching her genitals. The girl had also been drinking. Haggert was convicted of taking indecent liberties. He was given 3 years of probation and fined $500. Months later, he was charged with sexually assaulting a woman. He was also in trouble for violating his probation because he was spotted at a bar twice and missed a fine payment. The sexual assault charge was going to be hard to bring to trial because it was a he said, she said case. Instead, Haggert was convicted of violating his probation. In May 1974, he was sentenced to 2 to 10 years of prison. While in prison, Haggert became an excellent chess player. He also got into bodybuilding. Haggert was paroled in June 1977. After he was paroled, he moved back in with his parents. He began drinking again, and he was a mean drunk. In the summer of 1977, Haggert met 19-year-old Garnetta Ronning, who went by Netta. Netta was a waitress at a restaurant in Loomis, Michigan. Haggert was a regular at the restaurant. Haggert and Netta started dating. After a few dates, Netta became pregnant. While she was pregnant, Doris Arndt was murdered. The man Doris was seen arguing with the night she was murdered was Robert Haggert. The police questioned Haggert about Doris's murder, but he was never charged. Netta ended up having an abortion. Haggert was angry about this, and he broke up with Netta. They got back together 2 years later, and Haggert moved into her mobile home. Then they got engaged. Netta's family strongly opposed the marriage. But the couple were wed on February 28, 1981. Haggert continued to bar hop and forced Netta to stay home. Not long after getting married, the couple began having financial problems. Haggert was overspending and not working enough. Haggert had always wanted to be a livestock auctioneer, and he found work doing this, but wasn't stable. The couple then started writing checks that they knew would bounce. Netta's mother had to help the couple with money. Haggert then became physically abusive to his wife. In June 1981, Haggert wrote a bad check and the police started investigating him. Netta's mother told her that if she was going to stay with Haggard, she would no longer be able to help her financially. Weeks after writing the bad check, Haggard gathered as much money as he possibly could and fled the area. Shortly afterward, on June 23, 1981, Netta filed for divorce. Netta then moved to Florida for a change of scenery. Meanwhile, Haggard settled in Hailtown, Tennessee. A warrant for his arrest was issued in Michigan for writing the bad check. The divorce hearing was scheduled for February 17, 1982. Netta flew back to Michigan on February 14th. She stayed at her mother and stepfather's home in Farwell, Michigan. In the early 1980s, Farwell had a population of just over 800. On February 16, 1982, the day before the hearing, the family planned to have a small reunion to celebrate Netta's return. Haggard was not expected to appear at the hearing, especially since there was a warrant for his arrest. At about 6:30 p.m., Alice Russell, Netta's sister, and her family arrived at the home. Besides her father, Alice expected to find her sister, Helen Gaffney, and her four children there. When her father, George Post, called about half an hour earlier, she heard her sister disciplining her children in the background. Plus, when they arrived, Helen's truck was there. But what was odd was that the house was dark. When they got inside, they saw two figures on the kitchen floor. Initially, they thought they were Coates. When they turned on the lights, they realized it was the dead bodies of 23-year-old Netta and her 42-year-old mother, Vaudrey. Alice and her family ran from the house and went to a neighbor's home. The police arrived and they found more bodies. In 29-year-old Helen Gaffney's truck was her dead body, along with the dead bodies of her children, 10-year-old Angela, 8-year-old Tom, and 7-year-old Amy. 15-month-old Amanda was alive on the floor of the truck. Her only injury was a bump on the head. In the kitchen were Netta and Vaudrey's bodies. In the basement, close to the staircase, was the dead body of Netta's 53-year-old stepfather, George Post. All seven victims had been shot. In the house, Netta, George, and Vaudrey had all been shot in the chest with a shotgun. In the pickup truck, Helen had been shot in the chest with a shotgun. Tom was hit in the neck with pellets from the shotgun. Angela and Amy were both shot in the forehead with a .38 caliber handgun. Based on the evidence, the police pieced together what happened. The police believe that George was at the home with Helen Gaffney and her four children. George was killed first in the basement. Helen then got her kids into the truck and tried to drive away. Before she could start backing out of the driveway, the killer appeared in front of the truck. He shot Helen through the windshield with a shotgun, and some of the pellets hit 8-year-old Tom in the neck. The killer then used a .38 caliber handgun and shot 10-year-old Angela and 7-year-old Amy in the head. It's believed that in a desperate attempt to save her daughter Amanda's life, Helen knocked the toddler to the floor, and this is how she got the bump on her head. Then the killer covered up the blood on the ground with snow. He then waited in the house. When Netta and Vaudrey arrived home, he shot them in the chest. The police quickly surmised that Netta or Vaudrey were the targets. It was simply too risky to wait around the crime scene after killing the other family members. He must have been expecting them because he left soon afterward. He then fled in Vaudrey's 1980 white and blue four-door Buick LeSabre. The police talked to friends and family of the mother and daughter to see if anyone would want to hurt them, and one name kept coming up, Robert Haggard. Haggard's roommate in Hailtown, Tennessee, read about the murders. He noted that Haggard was driving a white and blue Buick LeSabre, so he called the police. Based on the license plate, they determined it was Vaudrey's stolen car. The police in Tennessee set up a roadblock and stopped Haggard. He was then taken into custody. In the car, the police found a fully loaded .38 caliber handgun. Haggard's apartment was searched, and some bloody clothes were found. 13 days after the murders, the shotgun was found under the couch at the crime scene. It belonged to George Post. .32-year-old Robert Haggard went to trial in September 1982. The prosecution had lost circumstantial evidence, but they didn't have something like Haggard's fingerprints at the crime scene or on the murder weapons. The police learned that Haggard took buses from Haletown to Farwell. Several people saw him on the buses. The police also found three witnesses who lived about half a mile from the crime scene. They knew the victims and Haggard. They drove past the property around the time of the murders. They saw Haggard near Helen Gaffney's truck. Ballistic testing was done on the .38 caliber handgun that was found in Vaudrey's car, which Haggard was driving when he was arrested. It was determined that was the handgun used in the murders. Some of the blood on the clothes in Haggard's apartment had unusual characteristics. Those characteristics were consistent with one of the victims. Haggard's lawyer did not call any witnesses or present any evidence. In his closing statement, Haggard's lawyer claimed that the prosecution had failed to prove Haggard's guilt beyond reasonable doubt. He said Haggard arrived at the family's home and found the dead bodies. He freaked out and got into the car, which had a .38 caliber handgun in it. He then drove away. The jury deliberated for 7.5 hours. Robert Haggard was found guilty on 6 of the 7 counts of first-degree murder. He was found guilty of second-degree murder in the killing of 7-year-old Tom Gaffney. The jury was not sure if Haggard intended to kill Tom. The jury concluded that his mother had been the victim, and Tom's murder was a byproduct of that. Haggard was given 7 life sentences, plus an additional 32 years of prison. The Rock Road Massacre, as it's been called, is the third worst mass murder in the history of Michigan. The 1927 Bath School disaster, where 45 people, including the perpetrator, were killed, is considered the worst. The Hazelwood Massacre in 1971, where 8 people were killed, is considered the second worst. We cover that case on our YouTube channel, Criminally Listed, in the video, 3 Disturbing Unsolved Mass Murders, Part 5. After getting the phone call from the journalist in 2007, the police reopened Doris Arndt's murder case. DNA technology had advanced, so Robert Haggard's DNA was compared to her killer's DNA. It was a match. In July 2009, 32 years after the murder of 29-year-old Doris Arndt, the police announced that longtime suspect Robert Haggard was the killer. However, Haggard was never charged. He died 6 years earlier of natural causes in November 2003 while in prison. He was 53 years old. Although the case took over 3 decades to resolve, Doris' family is happy that it was finally solved. Thank you so much for checking out this week's episode. Like we said in the opening, if you have any cases you want to suggest, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Well, that's all for today. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.